Hello, I'm Emma Desi, and welcome to another episode of Turning Readers into Writers. If you're brand new here, welcome, and here's what you need to know. This is a community that believes you are never too old to write your first novel. No matter what you've been up to until now, if you're ready to write your book, I'm ready to help you reach the end. I focus on helping you find the time and confidence to begin your writing journey, as well as the craft and skills you need to finish the book. Each week I interview debut authors, editors and industry experts to keep you motivated, inspired and educated on all things writing, editing and publishing. If you want to catch up, head on over to emmadesi.com where you'll find a wealth of information and tools to help you get started. Before we dive in, this week's episode is brought to you by my free cheat sheet, 30 Top Tips to Find Time to Write. In this guide, I give you 30 ways that you can find time to write in the small gaps that appear between the various errands and tasks and responsibilities that you have in your day-to-day life. Now, you might be thinking that you don't have any time to spare, but I can guarantee these top tips will give you writing time you didn't think you had. If you thought writing always involved a pen and paper or a keyboard, think again. If you thought you needed at least an hour at a time to write your manuscript, I help you reframe that. You won't be disappointed. Get your free copy of 30 Top Tips to Find Time to Write by going to emmadesi.com/30toptips. Okay, let's dive in to today's episode. September C. Fox's approach to editing has been described as thorough, precise, and kind. She has worked in the fiction writing industry for over 8 years and has been editing stories for even longer than that. She has edited for both award-winning and best-selling authors and has worked on manuscripts written for middle grade, young adult, and adult readers, with most of her experience being in the genres of fantasy and science fiction. Previous to freelance editing, she was mentored by a creative writing professor, an award-winning international best-selling author, and a professional editor. So let's delve into today's episode, where September gives us a one-on-one tutorial on the different types of cliffhanger there are, and when and if you should use them. So let's find out more. Well, welcome, September. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. It's really great to have you here.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So I'd love to just start with asking you, what was your journey to writing, to publication, to editing? How did you get to where we are now?
Yeah, so I'm kind of one of those, I feel like it's a little cliche, always wanted to work in this industry, always wanted to write or edit. And really, I wrote my first story when I was like 7 and I was like hooked, and I edited it too. It has like, in fact, my mom was really smart. So she kept it. We still have it. And I have it in a little binder. It was about chickens or something because we own chickens. But anyway, I had like blocked out like lines that I had, changed or whatever. So it has like all this stuff crossed out and like things are misspelled. But anyway, so that was kind of my first experience with that. And I was kind of hooked after that. Sometimes I feel like people get this idea though, that you have to have quote, like always wanted, to be in this industry to be successful. I don't feel that way at all. But I kind of was interested in that all growing up from that first time and knew this is kind of my plan A was I wanted to work in this industry. With that said, I didn't have a lot of, any kind of professional training or anything like that going on. Luckily now we have so much stuff on the internet, like even this podcast back, which I feel like wasn't that long ago, but even just like when I was growing up, I didn't have access to a lot of those things on the internet. Wasn't, on there. I didn't know where to look. So like, I did it, like I would write and me and my friends would share our stories and things all the time, but I still felt like as I became an adult and wanted to get serious into it, in some ways I feel like I still had to start at the beginning because I didn't have all that, I didn't have any training or mentorship. I shouldn't say I didn't have any, because obviously I took English classes and stuff growing up. But I still had a lot to learn. So from there, I went to college and I got my degree in English. And so that's when I kind of started getting more of a sense of kind of professional or industry and what's expected. And I became the managing, first I was the fiction editor, and then I was the managing editor of their literary journal. So I kind of did that and had that experience. And then after college, I started working as an assistant for a New York Times bestselling writer. His name's David Farland. He also does freelance editing. So after working for him for a while, he had me start going through manuscripts first, you know, and then he'd kind of go through after. So I kind of got more editing experience with that. I started my blog, and that's been a great little project where I just share my ideas about writing or what I've learned about writing on there. And from there, I started doing my own freelance editing services. So now I work for myself that way, and I edit people's manuscripts that way. So it's kind of the basic journey, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have any additional questions or anything about that, but that's kind of my story. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Well, yeah, no, I will do. I'll follow up on that a bit later when we get further along. But you mentioned your website there. I know you've got two websites. One is predominantly your blog, which we'll come to, but the other one is sort of more for your the editing work that you do, people specifically looking for an editor. You also have this great page on that website called Writing Tips. And when I was looking through it, what I love about it is you've broken it down into different sections. So you might have, you know, how to write the beginning of your book, how to brainstorm, how to write about characters or write dialogue. Such a useful index, such a useful resource. What prompted you to put it all together like that? So was there sort of a crying demand for it?
I thought it'd be helpful. Oh, okay. Well, I will say part of it's also for me, is I like to have these things organized on a website so I can just go click and look for what I'm looking for wherever I'm at. But I just thought it would be really helpful to have a lot of things that were organized by topic, just when we're kind of scrolling through, you know, on a website, okay, here's the topic that I'm looking at, here's different, you know, things that I can click on. A lot of them are, well, most of them are really are articles that I've written for my blog, but I do have some other articles in there that I often refer people to that maybe already explained something that, you know, I haven't written something on, or they've already done a good job on explaining it, so I'll send them there. Some of them are just articles like when I'm editing that I might suggest to people who are working on certain things. And I just think it's kind of a helpful way to learn more about the craft and like have it organized in that way. You can go on there, you can learn more about the craft and kind of help. I mean, it's great to have an editor, but you also need to know like the craft yourself, obviously. And it's good to be like a self-editor too. Mm-hmm. So the idea for that is just to make it more accessible. And so people can look up like whatever topic they're struggling with, they can go read about it.
Yeah.
And hopefully, I mean, I feel like there's a lot of stuff on there, but I keep, you know, keep updated and keep trying to add to it so that there's more.
No, there is a lot of stuff. And I'm going to link specifically to that page for people. I really think people should go and take a look at it. It'll be a real... just one of those tabs you have open on your desktop so you can refer to it regularly. I think it's great. But you do have your blog, as we've mentioned before, and it's a fantastic blog. I think it's a prize-winning, an award-winning blog, I think.
It's funny about that. So it's a Writer's Digest, which, if people don't know, is a pretty well-known magazine for fiction writing. They do awards every year. And it's funny because I had this dream that maybe someday, you know, I'll win this award. And I guess I won it, but I didn't know. I don't know how that happened. And so it wasn't till like months and months later, I found out on accident that I had won. And so that was really exciting for me. So yeah, I did win the Writer's Digest Award. So that was fun and exciting. So
yeah, well, I'm not surprised. It's really great. And I'm on your mailing list, and I got an email come through to tell me about the most recent one, which is about cliffhangers. And we were chatting just before we pressed record that it's not often you see something written about cliffhangers. So I was really intrigued to read it. And it seems that they're quite contentious, that some people love to have a cliffhanger in the book at the end of a chapter, perhaps. And then others really don't like it at all. So I wondered what your opinion was on it. You know, is it ever good to use a cliffhanger, or generally they should be avoided? What do you think?
Yeah, Yeah, it is funny because I have talked to people that have very strong feelings about cliffhangers, which is a little, I think it's a little funny, but I mean, I can get it. You know, people don't like having to wait or whatever. But I actually like cliffhangers, both definitely, you know, as somebody who's working on a project to make it better, but also, I don't know, even as an audience member, I like them and I like to hate them sometimes because you're kind of like, oh, why do I have to wait, you know? And so sometimes I wonder for some people, I'm like, do you really absolutely hate them or do you like to hate them? I don't know. But people usually, a lot of people have strong feelings about them. One of the common things that people say about cliffhangers is that, you know, it's good to have a cliffhanger to get the audience to start the next chapter or turn the page or start the next episode. And that's absolutely true. I mean, obviously, if you're going to suddenly cut something off that somebody, the audience really wants to know, and you cut away from the narrative, they're going to want to see what happens next. And so it is really effective that way. But I kind of feel like saying that's the only way it's effective, I feel like that, to me, that feels a little shallow. I feel like there's more to it than that. And I mean, you could just try to add a bunch of cliffhangers and then still have it not be a great story, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I feel like another good way to use them is when you have a cliffhanger, it gives the audience a second to pause and think about what's happening or what they think is going to happen. And so, like, maybe a good example of this is if you're writing like a murder mystery, you know, and they're about to figure out who the murderer is, maybe they're about to unmask them. You cut away, so there's a cliffhanger that gives the audience a second to kind of pause and think, who do I think is under the mask? Who do I think is the murderer? And usually, like, the cliffhanger is going to come at obviously a powerful moment because we want to see what happens next. And so sometimes I feel like the audience will just want to keep, you know, pushing, reading through it, which is okay. We want them to feel that way. But when you have a cliffhanger, they're forced to kind of stop and think for themselves. And so that's an example of, like, you know, maybe thinking, like, predicting what you think is going to happen. But sometimes a certain cliffhangers, when you stop, it makes people kind of self-evaluate, or I guess ask themselves, like, what would I do next, or mm-hmm. how would I get out of the situation? Mm-hmm. And I think those two things are really effective. They also, in that sense, you're inviting the audience to participate in the story. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I feel like one thing we have to watch out for is we might write stories that the audience feels more like a spectator as opposed to feeling like they're kind of like they're in the story. And so I feel like if you put the cliffhanger in the right spot like that, they're being invited to participate more by pausing and thinking what's going to happen next. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, I think they're also good for like really emphasizing a moment of suspense or shock or wherever you put it, because that's a moment the audience has to sit with that a little bit longer. Mm-hmm. And obviously, if you have it like at the end of the chapter, even just that white space of flipping over to the next chapter, you know, it just kind of, it adds emphasis to whatever you made a cliffhanger about.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. I hadn't thought about it in that way, that it's not just about getting them to turn the page, but actually to have a moment to have a think and pause and get almost more involved with the story because they're thinking about it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But you mentioned in the article that there are the four types of cliffhangers. So would that be sort of two of them, or are there more types?
Kind of, yeah. Well, so I will say, if you go read up on cliffhangers, people will categorize them differently. So I mean, this is the way that I categorize them, and it's kind of based on structure. So in story structure, you know, you're going to have the rising action, the climax, and the falling action. That's kind of the basic structure, and that will be true of the whole plot. But it's also true, like, on smaller things, like within a scene, you're going to have like a climactic moment, or within, you know, an act. So maybe the beginning, middle, and end, there's going to be a climactic moment within, you know, it's kind of like, I think of it as like a Russian nesting doll, that you have smaller shapes inside the bigger shapes. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so the climactic moment is sometimes called like a turning point because it turns the direction of the story. So it really can turn two ways. You can either have like a revelation, so like new information enters the story that changes our understanding or direction of it. The second way is an action, you know, something happens that changes the direction of the story. So even on a scene level, you're going to have, ideally, if you have things structured well and you have a plot that keeps moving, there's going to be a turning point or climactic moment in each scene. So for example, if I'm writing, an example would be like if I'm writing a murder mystery story, the climactic moment of the whole story is probably going to be when we figure out who the killer is. But if I'm just looking at a scene, you know, maybe the opening scene is when they first discover the dead body. Well, the climactic moment of that scene will probably be, when the dead body's discovered. So that kind of creates a climactic, that's a turning point, right? Mm-hmm. Everything's going fine. We found a dead body. Well, now we need to kind of deal with that. So keeping that in mind, so cliffhangers, I feel like, get down to knowing where to cut away in the narrative. Because sometimes I feel like we get this idea of, oh, I just need to throw in something. I need to throw something in really shocking and then cut away. And like that can work. I'm not saying it can't work. But ideally, if you have a great plot and you have your structure there, you're going to have lots of great moments like that. And what matters is when you choose to cut away from the narrative. So with that in mind, I kind of have it broken down four ways based on that. So the first one I call like a pre-point cliffhanger. So that's going to be before the turning point. So an example I'll give, I think a lot of people have seen Scooby-Doo, so I'm going to use Scooby-Doo as an example, right? Because I think most of us are familiar with the general format of those episodes. Basically, the Mr. Gang goes out, they find, you know, there's a ghost or there's a banshee or something. And towards the end of the episode, they're going to unmask it and see who it is. So the unmasking is going to be like the climactic moment, the turning point. So a pre-point cliffhanger is going to be, okay, Fred's about to pull off the mask, and then we cut away to a commercial. And so that kind of works in the sense that, well, the audience is really invested. They're anticipating a certain outcome. We want to know who the ghost is or whoever. And then we cut away. So that plays into the example I gave earlier. Well, now we have to sit for a second, and maybe we'll think about who we think it is or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I would call that a pre-point. The next one I would call a climactic cliffhanger. So when you get to the climactic moment, the turning point, sometimes in some stories, there will actually be more than one turning point. So a common thing that happens in a story is near the climax of the whole story. There will be like a character, the protagonist will have a realization that then allows them to decide, like take an action to defeat the antagonist. Sometimes those can be reversed, but you know, they realize something, okay, this is what I need to do to defeat the antagonist. So that's actually two turns, the realization and the action. So you can create a cliffhanger by cutting those in half. So you could have the character has the realization, boom, cliffhanger, and then when we come back, he'll take the action. And so that kind of works in that you have kind of in a sense, you know, maybe what the character is going to do next, and we'll have to kind of sit with that for a second. So it's kind of possible to cut it like during the climactic moment that way. The next one, the third one, I call the post point. So meaning that it happens just after the climactic point or turning point. So going back to our Scooby-Doo example, you know, in this scenario, you know, Fred goes over to the ghost, unmasks the ghost. Oh, we see it's George the electrician. You know, I'm just making this up. The next question we come to is, well, why? You know, why did George do this? What's the motivation? What are the ramifications of this? What are the characters going to do now? And so you can cut away right when we realize, oh, it's George the electrician. And that can create a good cliffhanger too. You know, it's a little bit different because we've passed over the turning point, but now we have new questions about, well, what's next? Why did he do it? What was his motivation? And so in a situation like that, the audience is waiting for, you know, like an explanation. They're waiting for meaning. Or what's gonna, you know, what's the new direction gonna be? And so you can cut away right there to kind of leave them sitting with that. then the fourth one, I call it the post-hook cliffhanger. So the idea is, so the shape, you know, rising action, climax or turning point, falling action. If you're working in anything smaller than the whole story, like if you're working with scenes, this shape's gonna repeat itself. You know, we're gonna have a scene that has rising action, climax, falling action. The next scene's going to have rising action, climax, falling action. And so what happens here with the post hook, usually at the starting of the scene, you're going to have like a hook, hopefully anyway, right? We all like hooks. And what you can do is you can cut right after a hook to create a good cliffhanger, because a hook is usually going to be in this situation. Usually it's going to be something like unexpected that disrupts what's going on or what the characters are trying to do. Or it might be like laying down the stakes, like what's at risk? Like, okay, if we don't do this, then this terrible thing's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And so you can have either of those and then cut away right after that to create a great cliffhanger. Because now, you know, we've had the hook. We want to know, well, what's going to happen? What's the rising action going to be? What are they going to do? And so it's possible to cut right there. I feel like we see this a lot in series. And a lot of, I don't know, you could just look at a lot of movies like Pirates of the Caribbean. Marvel does stuff like this, where you have like the whole story. There's like the falling action, you know, everyone's okay, we saved everyone or whatever. And then there'll be like an additional scene where you see like the bad guy is still alive and he's planning something evil, or, you know, someone else is alive and they're like, hey, we need to go do this now. There's this other issue. And then it like cuts off. And so basically what's happening there is we had the whole story. We got the climax. We got the falling action. And then we just barely hit a new hook for a new like rising action, which is probably going to be in the next installment, you know? And so by ending the book right there, like that's a good way to end a book if you want to end on a cliffhanger, because the audience still gets like the full story and they just get like a hint of what's going to come next. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you were to just like actually like cut off the book, like at the climactic moment or just after it, it probably wouldn't be very satisfying. So if you want to end a book or story with a cliffhanger, it's probably better to, you know, kind of wrap up that plot line and then just give enough of a hook or a hint of what's going to happen next, mm-hmm. and then end it. So basically, like, I guess the idea with this is sometimes we think, oh, I got to add all these cliffhangers, or I got to add something really shocking. But the thing is when you have these pieces together, those things are already there. You just have to know where to cut it. And so those are like the four places where you could cut away. You might cut to another plot line, another viewpoint. I mean, if you're doing television, I mean, most people are doing books listening. I'm more into the books, but, you know, cut to a commercial, whatever. But it's going to create, I guess, I feel like it will create better cliffhangers with less mistakes that can come up when you're just trying to throw in cliffhangers. Yeah, so those are the four types.
I think that's amazing. I mean, because it's when you describe it to us like that, I'm sure there'll be a lot of listeners going, oh yeah, there'll be a little aha moment going on. Yeah, it's not about having to create this false big da-da moment. It's already there in the script. It's the editing of the book and the positioning of when you, as you describe it, that cutaway of the narrative. So it's just looking for the right point to do that. That's brilliant. And also then you do have moments of those big da-da-da cliffhangers, mm-hmm. and also those smaller ones as well. So you can vary, I guess, the pace with the difference in cliffhangers as well.
Yeah, I think so too. I think one thing to be kind of careful with, if you are just like going to throw in cliffhangers, which I'm not going to say is always bad, because sometimes you get like a great idea for a cliffhanger and then you can work it into the story, you know. But what one thing to be aware of is where a lot of times they go wrong is when cliffhangers, writers are just like throwing in the cliffhangers to just try to get you to keep reading, and like they don't deliver on what's promised, you know. So like, you know, we could end a scene, well, not end, but we could have a character come into his house and his loved one is like lying there bleeding, you know, and we're like, oh no. And you cut away to create a cliffhanger. And then when we come back, oh, it's just ketchup. She just has ketchup all over her. You know, it's kind of a letdown. Okay. And so you want to make sure that but there's always exceptions. You want to deliver on whatever you're saying your cliffhanger is. Because if you're not delivering on those promises and it's a letdown too many times, then the audience is going to start having a problem with that, you know? And you kind of feel cheated, like, oh, they just threw that in there so that I would keep reading, you know, and it feels more shallow. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to say that's always wrong to do, because in certain genres, I feel like it can be effective. Like, I think we've all seen, well, I think most people have seen scary, jumpy movies, you know, where maybe there's like a babysitter walking down a dark hall and there's like creepy music and we're waiting for something to pop out, you know? And then maybe like we cut away or something and we come back and like the phone rings and we're like, oh, you know, that's it. And like, but sometimes it works in situations like that because it sets the tone and it plays with what the audience expects. So they don't know when it's going to be something terrible, when it's not, you know? Mm-hmm. And so you can kind of do some of that. That's where I would say you're kind of breaking the rule, but intentionally to kind of play around with the audience and what they expect. But even a lot of times in a situation with that, you know, say, okay, so I'll go back to their example. We see, you know, the protagonist goes in, sees his loved ones covered in blood, cuts away, comes back. Oh, it's actually ketchup. That's kind of a letdown. Well, what happens is the audience kind of relaxes right then. So what would be good is then you can then bring in something, you know, really scary. Oh, then a monster came out and, you know, attacked her, because we're not, the audience isn't expecting, because they're like, oh, it was just ketchup. And then bam, you know, and then they're like, oh. So you can play around with them in different ways to kind of break different rules and create those effects. But generally speaking, I think, paying attention to those turning points you have in your scenes or where, whatever level you're working at, and cutting around those is probably the safest, best way to go.
Oh, love it. Love it. Now I'm going to change tack slightly. Oh, and just to say, I'll link to that blog post directly so that people can go and kind of digest it as well, because there's a lot in there. But I am going to change tack a little bit, and I'd love to just kind of learn a little bit more about, you know, you what you do in your editing work. One of the questions I get asked a lot is, okay, what are the types of editing, first of all? Because we know that there's quite a few different types. I wonder if you could just walk us through, I think it's 3 or 4 different types, and then the ones that you focus on.
Yeah, okay. So yeah, there are different types of editing. I will say, just as a kind of heads up, is I have found certain people sometimes define them slightly differently from each other. And I feel like there's a lot of things in the writing industry like that. Like, people are like, no, this is called the inciting incident. No, this, you know. So I'll go through, you know, the way I understand it. But it's worth keeping in mind when you're looking around that somebody might have a slightly different definition, and that doesn't mean they're wrong or terrible. But anyway, so there's content editing. It's sometimes called developmental editing, and that's going to be more like the big picture stuff. So like character, you know, character arcs, plot, theme, maybe world building, all those big picture things about like what the story actually is. That's how I think of it. Like what is the story at? What is it actually, you know, what is it, what's happening in it? What's the content of it? How does it play out? Like big picture things. And then below that, you're going to have line editing. And line editing is, I think of it more of the way the story is being told. So like maybe, you know, sometimes they'll be like, okay, I feel like this chapter needs more voice in it, or this pacing is too fast, or you know what, these descriptions are long and boring, or I'm trying to think of, so you need a cliffhanger maybe. You know, so it's going to be more about like how the author is telling the story, and I'll, you know, help them with ideas of how they can tell it better. With books, we're going to be dealing with the way it's actually written on the page too. You know, maybe you have too much passive voice or whatever. Mm. And so looking at the actual writing and how to make that better. After that, you have copy editing. So this is often what people think of when they think of editing. This is where you're going to look for things like typos and punctuation and grammatical errors and things like that, and tighten that stuff up. Maybe sometimes wordiness. I sometimes put wordiness more with line editing. But anyway, and then after that, you also have, I guess, yeah, you have proofreading. Sometimes I see people kind of put those together, but they are slightly different. So proof editing usually happens after copy editing, and it's kind of the last thing where you just go through the whole manuscript, make sure, you know, it looks right, check for typos again, all those types of little things before it's ready to be published or printed or whatever. Mm-hmm. So those are the four different types that I would break down.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And do you do all four of those, or do you focus on one more than another?
Yeah, so I mostly do content and line editing. I can do, I can do the other two, but I do copy editing sometimes, not as much. There's just a lot of little things to look at with that, which is fine. But I'm more interested in, you know, let's get down, what is the story? How do we make the story itself better? And how do we tell the story better and more effectively? That's really where I like to focus on the most. So that's really what most of my work ends up being. I occasionally do copy editing. I only take on so much at a time of copy editing, just because it's really, I find it hard to be focused on all the commas and all the, you know, periods in the right spot for so, like, that hyper-focused for so long, because I'm trying to catch everything. The other stuff is demanding in its own way, but it's more interesting to me, and I don't have to be, like, I guess, so perfect watching all the little commas and dots and everything. Yeah. I like talking about the story. I like helping writers see how they can tell the story more effectively, what works, what doesn't. And I like teaching those concepts, too, when I work with them.
Yeah, that's one thing I have learned about working with an editor, which I didn't expect at all, was how much of a craft lesson it is. So every time I send my book for an edit, it comes back with the teaching that you just mentioned. And I learn so much that I'm then able to carry on into my next manuscript. And then that gets edited and I learn more. And I hadn't kind of seen it from that point of view until it happened. And it's invaluable. It's absolutely invaluable. Because, so, you know, if someone listening out there is going to go with a traditional deal, if they manage to get one, that's great. You know, the publisher is going to deal with all of those different layers of editing. For those that end up or choose to go down the self-publishing route, what, from your point of view, do you think, because editing, it is an investment, undoubtedly, especially when you're just starting out. From your point of view, what do you think is the most important edit that an indie author should prioritize? Would it be the developmental? Would it be the copy editing, the line editing? What do you feel is the most important?
Well, I feel it kind of depends where the writer's at, you know, and their skills. I think content and line editing. Content's obviously really important, because if the story isn't effective, then it doesn't matter how it's written. But on the other hand, if it's not written very well, then nobody is going to care about the story. So it's kind of, to me, it's kind of a balancing act between those two things. If you were on, I mean, say, because it can be an investment, if you were on a tight budget, I would say you probably want to get content development editing. And that, usually when I do that, it's cheaper than online editing, right? Or copy editing, because in those I'm going through each line and checking each thing. Whereas content developmental, I'm looking at the big picture. So I can look at the big picture and tell you, you know, these are the things you need to fix in the story. If somebody's, you know, tight financially, I guess, or they want to just get the most out of their money or decide prioritize, what I might would do sometimes is I'll be like, okay, I'm going to give you a content edit, and then for line issues, as opposed to going through each line, I will add some sections in my critique letter about overall issues related to lines that you can then apply through, so that I don't have to comb through everything. Another option I would maybe say is, you know, I'll do a content developmental edit, and then maybe we can do a section of line editing so that you can see what needs to be improved and you can apply that through the rest.
Okay.
Ideally, you know, I would say get both content and line editing and copy editing, and, you know, but I understand that that can't be quite an investment. Mm-hmm. But I do think content and line editing is pretty important. Most people I work with don't have terrible grammar and punctuation. And I think, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but, like, if I see a comma in the wrong spot, it's not going to ruin the story for me, you know? And so, ideally, I would say get all of them, but if you have to prioritize, I think content and line editing is probably the place to go, in my opinion.
That's good advice for everyone. Now, just in terms of you and what you work with and what you enjoy working with, are there any particular stories or genres that you like working with, or are you happy to kind of try everything and anything?
Yeah, so most of my experiences with fantasy and science fiction, and even I was thinking about it the other day, even more fantasy than science fiction, but those are the genres that I really love to work with. I've done adult, YA, middle grade for any of those. I have worked outside of those genres. I've done just general fiction, and I've done memoirs and a few other things. But mostly that's where most of my work is science fiction and fantasy. That's kind of where, I guess, my expertise is. That's mm-hmm. where I've done a lot of that type mm-hmm. of stuff. And I'm really okay with working for any kind of age, you know, middle grade. I mean, I don't do picture books or really young readers, so I wouldn't be able to help people with that. But middle grade, young adult, and adult, I have all worked in. And really people of all levels. I've worked with people who have had bestsellers, and I've worked with people who are, you know, brand new, or people who are just getting into writing that they just want some help with. So all mm-hmm. different levels I've helped with. So in that regard, I'm usually pretty open. Yeah.
Cool. And do you have any advice for particularly new writers? So say they've written their first manuscript and they've done all their revisions. But is there anything kind of that they can do in terms of editing or revision that, you know, from experience, you've seen sort of common mistakes that people make or common areas for improvement, shall we say, that we can work on ourselves before hiring an editor, so that when we do make that investment, we're getting the best that we can out of that editor?
Yeah, so one of the common problems I see that I feel like actually doesn't get talked about very much, which is why I'm going to bring it up. It's best way I explain it is a lot of writers tend to want to look backward in their story, meaning they want to look at what happened to the character previously, what happened before the story started. They want to look at the backstory, how we got to this point, and those things all have a place. But a lot of times writers, and I think part of this is from like maybe the writer hasn't yet completely figured out what the story was when they started writing it. And so it's helpful for the writer to look at, okay, where was this character before? How did we get here? Or what happened before this? This is going to be so interesting. And what happens is, like, when I sit down with the manuscript, like, I feel like we're kind of living in the past a little bit. Sometimes writers will start like in the present and then they'll go into the past for a while, which isn't always wrong. But it starts to kind of feel like the writer's focusing more on the past. And I think of it as like they're looking backward to how what happened before the story started or what happened previously. The audience actually wants to look forward, present or forward, right? We usually want the story to mostly be in the present. You can always break rules. And then they want to anticipate what's going to happen, because that's what's going to make them want to keep reading. They want to see, oh, what's the outcome? What's this going to be? What's this going to be? And so my experience is a lot of new writers, they tend to look at, well, how did we get here? How did this character become this way? The audience likes more of, this is where we are now. Here are some stakes on the line and what could possibly happen. And the thing is about the future is we don't know what could happen, hasn't happened yet. And so it's more interesting and it draws the audience in, because it's like, okay, trying to think of an example. If she gets invited to this party, you know, she can meet this guy she has a crush on, or if she doesn't, then it's going to create another issue. I'm just throwing in an example. And so when you have something that has like, okay, you have this one element that has two different outcomes for the future, we're suddenly more interested in seeing what happens in the present, because we want to see what ends up happening. And so it gets the audience to anticipate the rest of the story. So they'll want to keep reading and they'll want to know what happens. And once they start caring about that more, they're going to be a little more interested in what happened before, if that makes sense.
Okay.
So yeah, that's one of the things that I would say, probably easier said than done. But
so it's not what we might call front loading. You know, sometimes I've heard that phrase used, that like in the beginning of a story, the writer piles everything, the whole history of the character and everything that led them up to this point, and then move on. Is that what you're talking about, or is it something different?
Well, sorry, clarify what you mean.
So I've heard this sort of term front loading, when you front load the story with everything that's happened to the character up until the point that we start the actual book, you know, so we get the character's whole back history, their family, their schooling, everything in that first chapter or two before we start the story. Is that the same thing that you're talking about now, or is it two different things?
Yeah, well, it kind of depends how it's done. I guess the idea is you don't want to spend too much time just talking about like the past and the backwards. You want to be anticipating what could happen when you're writing it. It's okay if you as the writer know that. Mm-hmm. But if you're putting in like a huge encyclopedia entry about, you know, this character, how they were born and then grew up and all this stuff before the story actually starts, it's usually very hard to pull that off and be interesting. It's not impossible. So, you know, because I know people are going to be like, well, so-and-so did this and it worked. Like, yeah, it works. But a lot of times it's difficult to pull that off. It's more interesting usually if you start in the present and then put in, like, if you've heard the term stakes. I think of stakes as, like, potential outcomes. You know, if this happens, then this happens. So if you can put something like that in it, that's a little more interesting. And then you can kind of weave in some of the background stuff as you move forward in the story. Mm-hmm. Does that kind of make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. So, I mean, I wouldn't say it's always wrong to start the other way, but it's very difficult to pull off, especially if you're a newer writer. Mm-hmm. And it's usually more interesting if you do it the other way. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yay. Gosh, you've given us so much today. All the stuff about cliffhangers, and then, you know, about the sort of those common mistakes that you've seen, those problem areas. You've given us a lot of to think about and a lot to kind of work on for our own manuscripts. So thank you very much. If any of our listeners are kind of interested in finding out a bit more about how they can work with you, what's the best way of doing that?
Yeah, so you can find me, if you're interested in editing services, you can go to foxediting.com. It's kind of just where I have all my editing services info. My blog articles and everything is just septembercfox.com. But if you can't remember, like if you can't remember my name for some reason, you can also get to it by going to writebetterwithaneditor.com, and that's going to pull up all my blog articles. There's some other references and things you can look at on there. Other than that, I'm on most social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Tumblr. I don't know. Is that all of it? But anyway, so you can also find me there. But yeah.
Fantastic. September, it's been so lovely speaking to you and finding out, you know, all about what you do. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I hope you found that helpful and inspirational. Now, don't forget to come on over to Facebook and join my group, Turning Readers into Writers. It is especially for you if you are a beginner writer who is looking to write their first novel. If you join the group, you will also find a free cheat sheet there called 3 Secret Hacks to Write with Consistency. So go to emmadesi.com/turningreadersintowriters, hit join. Can't wait to see you in there. All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.